Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and I'm very pleased to say that my guest on this programme is Mark Forsyth, whose first book, The Etymologicon, subtitled A Circular Stroll Through the Hidden Connections of the English Language, was published to great acclaim last year. It was described as the stocking filler of the season by Robert McCrum in The Observer, and also made several appearances on the bestseller lists. Mark will be hoping to repeat that performance this Christmas with his new book, The Horologicon, and I would rate his chances highly. There are many quirky word books which aim to be funny, but in my experience, many of them fall short. Not so The Horologicon, in which Mark takes you on a journey through the lost words of the English language, pausing hour by hour to offer you a feast of forgotten words, some of which you might wonder how you ever did without. Who would not be better off for knowing that a single serving of toothpaste on a brush is properly known as a nurdle, and that companies have gone to law over their depiction, or that the protector's sleeve round your coffee cup is a zarf? And anyone who has ever worked in an office will surely relish the discovery that there is a word for the activity of being stupid together, consulting, oh so gloriously adjacent to consulting, that nod crafty means possessing the guile to know exactly when to nod in response to someone's remarks, or that the word agenda has, if not precisely an opposite, then a dark other, tassenda, those things which cannot be mentioned. It's rare that I laugh aloud at books, but I did when reading The Horologicon. I met Mark recently in Bristol, shortly before his event at Blackwell's and Park Street there. The biographical note on his book says he received a copy of the Oxford English Dictionary as a christening present. Was this really true, I asked?
That's absolutely true, yes. And it's even got, my godfather had it monogrammed with my initials on it, and I still have it. And it's rather wonderful. But there's only the two-volume version. It's the big one, but it's not the really big one. The really big one's 18 volumes and takes up half of a room.
And at what age were you when you first appreciated this gift?
Hard to say. I don't know. It's always nice to have, and I would look things up in a childish way in this massive volume. And then, just as I started to get interested in etymology slowly, I mean, I don't think there was any really precise moment where I have to, you know, that's that. But there are so many points where you go, wait, what is it? What is it about? Why do we say that? Well, why do we turn up for the books? How do you turn up for a book? What on earth is that? And then you look in the dictionary and you discover that it's a turn up for the bookies, for the bookmakers, because when an unbacked horse comes in, that's a good thing for the bookmakers. Or, I mean, I once had this weird thing of I was wandering through the Capuchin crypt in Rome, which is that's an order of monks called the Capuchins, and they, whenever they died in this monastery in Rome, their skeletons would be taken and used to decorate this crypt. So it's utterly strange and freaky. It's loads of lampshades made out of human skulls and stuff like that. It's like a serial killer's basement. And all I could think about as I was wandering around was Capuchin, Cappuccino. Is there a connection? And I looked it up later and found indeed there was a Cappuccino's name, that because it's the same colour as the robes of the Capuchin monks. And it's that sort of wow moment. Oh, you know, I'd always known those two words, or for years I've known those two words. And then suddenly to put them together is a great moment of realisation. It's like solving a crossword clue or something like that. It's that moment of enlightenment.
And so you're not just discovering things about words, you're discovering things about how our ancestors lived, you know, what things were important to them, how they organized their lives, what made their hearts beat faster.
Yeah, all of that stuff, it's amazing. And I've had a lot of that with the Horologicon too. I've found that when you read these, that there are loads and loads of dictionaries of little sections of slang, little slices of life. So a dictionary of Second World War soldiers slang, or a dictionary of Cab Calloway, the great band leader of the 1940s. He actually wrote a dictionary, and I discovered this, and I got hold of a copy, and it says Dictionary of Hepcat Slang, the Language of Jive. And it's amazing reading these little dictionaries, because you get this little slice of life, a little portrait of a world, and all the things they had to have a name for, which are now absolutely gone.
There's a wonderful phrase of how to ask a girl out to the pictures, I think, in that dictionary,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Do you want to catch a glim this early light, early bright, I think it is, yes.
That made me think of something like, you know, Clockwork Orange or something, that's that degree of sort of concentrated slang.
Yeah, it's amazing. But also the great thing about dictionaries is that you get an unexpurgated view of what the world used to be like. So if you read a dictionary of, say, you know, Shropshire slang from the 18th century, it will have all those beautiful old rustic pastoral things, you know, names for thickets and little lanes winding through the woods and fog in the morning and all that sort of stuff, and you go, ah. And then it will also have names for all these disgusting skin diseases and fungal infections of the horse and other things. So you go, oh, I'm very glad I don't live in those times anymore. But you also get this utterly even-handed little portrait of a world, which is beautiful.
And you haven't just been truffling around in what you refer to as the unfashionable pages of the Oxford English Dictionary. You've gone off-piste, haven't you? And you've gone into even more recondite areas of vocabulary hunting.
Yeah. My rule for writing the Horological, which is a collection of strange words, is if they'd ever appeared in an English dictionary, that was good enough for me, even if it was the descriptive atlas of sexology and dictionary of sexology, which does actually contain maps, weirdly enough, or any old dictionary. There are loads of, back in the 19th century, lonely clergymen would be collecting up the rural terms of the farmers in their areas. There are loads of those dictionaries. And then there are dictionaries of highwaymen slang. This 17th and 18th century people desperately wanted to know the language of what they called the canting crew, who spoke cant. And you have these wonderful dictionaries which summon up, as I say, a world of highwaymen and sabres and huge numbers of euphemisms for being hanged.
And you make a very telling, I thought it was something that had never really occurred to me before in your preface. You say the alphabet is a completely arbitrary way of organizing information. So things which have relationships can be volumes apart. Therefore, you have eschewed the alphabet in your Horological. So tell me how you decided to put together the material you've amassed.
Well, yeah, the alphabet is rubbish because you can't say, oh, what's that word? Is there a word for that? And just turn to the Oxford English Dictionary and flick through, because it's 18 volumes of very small print. It takes about a year to read, and the conversation probably moved on by the time you found the word. So what I did was I took all these strange words that I found and I arranged them by the hour of the day when they might come in useful. So, for example, there's an old English word, utkeara, which means lying awake before dawn, worrying about the day to come. Now, I've suffered from utkeara many, many times, but I didn't know there was a word for that. So that's in chapter one, which is the dawn and waking up. And then chapter two is all about washing in the bathroom and going to the lavatory. And then there's a chapter on breakfast. And the whole thing is done in continuous prose. I think that's an important thing to say. It's not just a list of words. It's a description of the average, the generic day, and then all the words which might be useful in it. So at lunch, you might come across a gastrophilanthropist, which is somebody who buys you lunch. But you also might come across a scambler. A scambler is somebody who, when you're paying, orders all the most expensive things on the menu. And all of these people and events and things still exist. Mm. And there are these old words hidden in these dictionaries for them. So that's how it's arranged. And it's all the hours of the day and all the things which I think you'd probably be doing at that hour. And the words which might come in useful to you.
Now, how did you establish your criterion for inclusion? Because a small number, admittedly, of these words are actually in my active vocabulary. So they're obviously not words which are... Well, matutinal and sprezzatura I've definitely used. But I mean, that's only a couple. But I mean, that's the serious question, I suppose. But how did you actually decide when a word was sufficiently obsolete or recondite to merit inclusion?
Largely, I had to take a guess. Some of them are actually... It's funny when people say most people don't know matutinal. But I was talking to the publicist at my publisher. So his father apparently uses the word mugwump all the time. And I thought I was the only person who knew that word. So a few of them are definitely still clinging on. And sprezzatura is a beautiful one. I once got a school report, it's my favourite school report ever, from my maths teacher, saying that I had sprezzatura, which made me prouder than anything ever. And he had to explain what it meant.
Maybe you should just quickly explain it for listeners.
Sprezzatura is... this will make me sound incredibly arrogant. Sprezzatura is the only good school report I ever received, I should point out. Sprezzatura is the nonchalance of the perfect courtier. It comes from Castiglione's Book of the Courtier, and it's the perfect Renaissance gentleman should be brilliant at everything, but make it seem effortless. He should never be seen to do any hard work at all. He should just, you know, come up with the goods as though it were incredibly easy. And so sprezzatura is about disguising the effort you're making, because obviously you do have to make the effort, really, but you should never let anybody see that. It's the artful nonchalance of the perfect courtier.
And your maths had that. That's admirable. Where were the richest hunting grounds for words, Mark?
My favourite was Captain Groves's Dictionary of the Vulgar Tongue. Captain Groves was a a wonderful man. He was an artist and he was a soldier. And he used to, first of all, he obviously in the barracks, he managed to pick up all these strange slang terms. And he also used to ride around England. He was an 18th century painter. He painted ruins and he rode around England doing all this until he got so fat that no horse could hold him. But he did write the first really big slang dictionary. I mean, it's not that big. It's a couple of hundred pages. And it's filled with absolutely amazing and extraordinary words which you wouldn't have thought existed. So that was my favourite happy hunting ground.
And it's really striking that the physicality and the onomatopoeic quality of many of the words, especially if they come from the Middle Ages or 18th century slang. Yeah. I've wrote down jumble gut lane for a bumpy road, and thrumble of a kettle. I don't know where that originates, but there are lots of those words of that ilk, aren't there, from slang terminology.
My favourite one to say is wamble cropped. It's just beautiful, beautiful word to say aloud. And a wamble cropped means overcome with indigestion. You've a little bit of indigestion is a touch of the wambles. Your stomach is wambling. But when you really can't do anything because it's so bad, then you're wamble cropped. There's also zwodder. Zwodder is a beautiful word. It's a old Devonshire dialect, a West Country dialect word for a drowsy or sleepy state of mind. And if you say zwodder, you can't help but feel that you're in that drowsy, sleepy state.
And because you've arranged it according to what people do as the day goes by, a lot of them are about physical things, aren't they? They're about waking up, or they're about eating, or having sex.
Actually, I didn't do a chapter on sex.
You somewhat coy on that, actually.
I thought the jokes would be so cheap. And it would be the same joke over and over and over again. Like, did you know there's this weird perversion? Here's a funny word for it. So I consciously avoided sex. The rudest word in there is a very strange word I came across. It was in Grose's Dictionary, the Vulgar Tongue. I was sitting in the British Library reading it cover to cover. And they're all these great words. But then my jaw sort of fell, went straight through the desk, through the floor beneath me and into the stacks, because I came across the word feig. To feig a horse is to put a live eel up its bottom, a common trick amongst horse traders to make an old horse look livelier. And you go, my God, there's a word for that. There must be a word for everything. It's an amazing, amazing moment.
And
unfortunately, there's no hour of the day when that actually, when most people feig. So I had to just mention it in the preface.
I wonder if it could be used figuratively. I wonder if that's a way to reintroduce it.
Possibly, yes.
I mean, do you hope that some of these words will be taken up and revived and have a...
I would love that, yes. I'd really love that, because it's such a shame that they are dying or forgotten, or these incredibly... I mean, fudgeling, for example, everyone fudgels. To fudgel is to make a show of pretending to do some work whilst not actually doing anything. It's what you do when your boss walks past in the office, fudgeling. And there are so many great words like this. I'd love it if they made it back into the common vocabulary.
Do you think we're as good today at making up new words as they were in the past? We think of online, I suppose that's an area where we make up new terms and social media and all those things. Are you less enticed by those words than the ones of the past?
I think there are some great ones. The past always has, I mean, this is just an observation about life. The good things of the past tend to be preserved and they survive, which is why you look at all, you know, old buildings are always beautiful and a lot of modern buildings aren't. But of course, the ugly modern buildings probably get demolished over the next few hundred years, and there probably were ugly buildings a few hundred years ago. And I think the same thing happens with language and words. We do have some great little computer ones. I mean, you know, spam, meaning emails you don't want, which has a fascinating etymology, a strange little story which I told in the Etymological, my book last year. And yeah, they pop up, and some of them will disappear, the useless ones, and the useful ones and the nice sounding ones are there. I think they'll tend to survive.
And you're able to dip into subcultures like the 19th century smoking subculture, which looks as though over a short period generated lots and lots of different terms for this sort of...
It's will ye raise a cloud. It's a far better way than fancy a smoke. Will ye raise a cloud? And Nicotina, the goddess of nicotine, or the goddess of tobacco, and all these very strange words. And I discovered they used to have a thing called smoking matches, where people would competitively smoke for a prize. Very strange.
And did you, I mean, did you spend days in the British Library prospecting, as it were, for nuggets of gold and having to sift through pages and pages of dross in order to come up with the thing you wanted?
Yes, I did. More than days.
Well, I meant at a time for you know, per nugget.
I actually like reading dictionaries. That's probably because I'm a sad and lonely and boring person, but I really enjoy it, partially, as I say, because you get this little portrait of a world that's gone. And I love following the leads up and finding the original usage of the word and the strange contexts that you find them in. I mean, I found a medieval book of etiquette and manners, and this is in the 2 to 3 o'clock section, an after lunch nap, and it was how a knight in shining armour should take a nap after lunch if he has to. And apparently you should never do it sitting down or lying down. You should lean against a cupboard and fall asleep. That's the correct one if you before going off to fight a dragon.
Famously, a previous editor of the Grove Dictionary of Music inserted the biography of an entirely apocryphal Scandinavian composer into the book. And I wonder, did you ever think that some 19th century clergyman was having a joke, had actually made up something, that some one of these...
Quite possibly I did.
Aha!
There is one word in this book, which is absolutely and utterly made up off the top of my head. I mention it right at the back of the appendixes and epilogues.
Where the timid will not...
Exactly. But to find out which word it is, you'd have to read through all 2,000 words in the book and check them all against all of the dictionaries, which would be impossible. So it will never be found out, and I would have introduced one extra word into the language. Yeah.
Mark Forsyth. The Horologicon is out now in hardback. For more information about this book, as well as Mark's previous one and several million other titles besides, go to blackwell.co.uk. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Podcast, but I'll be back again soon with another programme. You can make sure you never miss the programme by subscribing to it on iTunes. It's free, quick and easy. Go to the iTunes store and type Blackwell Podcast in the search box, and a subscription is just a couple of clicks away. Until next time, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.